Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and right now it is time to bring together people you like and get some good food going. So we've a menu or two lined up for you and a totally iconoclastic holiday dessert that takes 5 minutes, so ditch that 8-hour Bouche de Noël. Nigel Slater, England's treasured food writer, talks nostalgia at the table. And for partying with intriguing liquids, how about making your own sodas, even fermented ones? It's a new take on bubbly. So stick around for ideas, your calls, and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, this is the time of year that I wish Ray Isle lived across the street. Ray is executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine. Ray, good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
Well, it's the time of year when we're thinking wine buys, and I understand you've been doing some investigating on real deals in wine.
Yeah, I have. I figured it is the time of year when you're looking for bargains because you don't want to spend a titanic amount of money on, you know, multiple parties. And so what I did was I went to a friend who works at Zaki's, which is a very well-known and very large store here in New York, and got some sort of retail idea tips. So one of the things, you know, is that popular wines, the kind of the big selling wines, like Chardonnay, mid-priced Chardonnay from California, rarely go on sale because the retailers know they're going to be able to sell those wines. So what instead, if you look for wines from Alsace, for instance, or from Abruzzo in Italy, or from Alto Adige, for the sort of less well-known places, those are wines that they're more likely to put on sale during the holiday season because they want to move, you know, everybody who has a store wants to sell wine, and those are the categories that are a little harder to sell. And, you know, weirdly enough, the retailer I was talking to said, you know, if a wine isn't on sale and it's not something, you know, it's not a really well-known popular wine, if it's something slightly esoteric, you can ask and see if they'll possibly give you a deal on it, you know, especially if you're going to buy a case or something. But oddly enough, there's some flexibility involved in the whole thing, which was news to me.
Wait a minute, you're saying you can bargain with a wine merchant?
There's always a little bit of flexibility in pricing, and you may get shut down, but you also may, you know, you may, yeah. The guy may say, sure, great. You know, most stores also, you know, it's pretty common that if you buy a case of wine, 12 bottles, stores will often offer a 10 to 15% discount on that. That's pretty standard. You won't get that at something like necessarily like a Safeway or, you know, grocery store, but a wine shop, typically there's a case discount on wines.
Is there a country where there are particularly great buys?
Oh, yeah. Argentine Malbec has been hugely popular over the past few years, and part of the reason is that you can get incredible quality for a really moderate price, 10, 12 bucks, and you can get a really nice bottle of red wine. I think additionally, the sort of Mediterranean coast of Spain, places like Humilla and Yecla, which produce wines from a great Pol Monastrell, those wines can be a great deal, again, for red wines. I think also, you know, some of the sort of less well-known regions aren't necessarily, you know, rock-bottom cheap, but offer great quality for price. And so, for instance, you know, I've been saying for holiday drinking a lot of times Alsace wines, Pinot Blanc from Alsace, Riesling from Alsace. And Riesling from Alsace tends to be dry, really, really lean and crisp. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be cheap. It's not going to be like $5 a bottle. But for what you get for $15, it's an extraordinary deal. And that's, you know, value is a sliding scale to some degree.
Yeah, I understand. What about in the States? Where are the bargains? Is there a state that's going to give us a great bargain?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of really good red wine coming out of Washington State right now. You can get a top, you know, pretty terrific Cabernets for $20 a bottle, $15 a bottle that I think give you, because Washington's a little less well known than say Napa Valley and Sonoma, I think that the kind of quality for money is a better equation there. And so, you know, and I think, you know, the other thing that's fun, there's been a real boom in winemaking around the country in pretty much every state. And it's not always a bargain proposition, but it's kind of fun to drink wines from your own state. You know, I mean, here in New York, there's some fantastic wines coming out of the Finger Lakes. And it just gives a little kind of local, you know, nice local vibe to your dinner.
Okay, what about the party challenge? What are your thoughts about inexpensive but really decent drinking wines for big parties?
Well, for big parties, I tend to stay away from the Chardonnay Cabernet zone because you're paying a little bit for, in a sense, for the brand. I mean, Cabernet Sauvignon, for instance, is a grape, but it's basically become a brand name. And so you're going to pay more. So a couple of wines I've had recently, there's a Viognier from McManus family, 2010, $11 a bottle, really lovely wine. Anybody who likes Chardonnay is going to love it. There's a Chianti I had recently called La Maialina, 2010. It's again about $10 a bottle, which is kind of my I like that $10 zone for party wines, because especially if you buy a case of wine, you're getting down to $8.50 a bottle or something like that. And that La Maialina Chianti is crisp, it's bright, you know, really kind of beautiful berry, strawberry aroma to it, and it's just a very adaptable and very drinkable red wine that's not too heavy, but has a lot of flavor to it. Again, Malbec, Elsa Bianchi, 2010. That's about a $10-$11 bottle of wine, and that's a classic example of Argentine Malbec and the value it offers for $10.
These really sound good. Ray, thank you, and you have a great holiday.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be on the show.
Executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine. Now, you can find his wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, Ray may have the wines, but I have got the menu. And it has the works, from slow roasted pork with glazed orange slices to a big finish of double pear pudding cake with warm caramel cognac sauce, and with lots of veggies in between. So find this winter holiday dinner on our holiday page at splendidtable.org. So what does a man who lives and breathes food practically 24 hours a day have on his Christmas table? A good bottle of wine with a straw, you say? Well, maybe, but the man I'm talking about is the renowned British food writer, Nigel Slater. Nigel, welcome.
Lynn, hello. Hello.
So, Nigel, where do you go with your food at this time of year?
Purely comfort. There is something about this time of year that makes me feel I want everything I eat to be like a sort of warm, cozy blanket. And so I choose things that are a little bit richer than they would be at any other time of year. And I choose things that also remind me of when I was younger, when I was a child. It's a very good time, I think, to press the nostalgic button on the food scene.
So what are these things?
Well, they're things that smell of Christmas. So anything with clementines and mandarin oranges, anything with marmalade, anything with, I suppose, spices and sugar. It's the sweet mincemeat and treacle and golden syrup and maple syrup. Things that are sugary. And of course, there's a practical reason for this, because they give us energy, they keep us warm, mm-hmm. but also they're very comforting on the tongue, and they remind us, I think, of when we were younger and could be much more carefree with the amount of sweets we ate.
This sounds all lovely and it's sweet, but what about on the savory side?
Well, on the savory side, Christmas is extraordinary here because everybody wants, in theory, new ideas. Oh, we want something new for Christmas to read about. We want something to look at in a book or a magazine, or maybe even possibly dream of cooking something totally different. But when it actually comes to the crunch, don't even think of doing anything that isn't traditional. We really want the big bird. You know, we want something to carve, something golden to bring to the table to say welcome, a big hello to put it in the middle of the table. We want rather too many vegetables, and we want sweet and sticky and alcoholic puddings. And don't think about doing anything else.
Do you do food gifts at all?
Well, I hadn't used to do food gifts. But the strange thing is that the older I get, the more I realise that actually people are quite difficult to buy for, particularly people that you've given gifts to for a number of years. And yet, make something yourself and wrap it up and hand it to them. And you just see their eyes light up. And I think it's partly because it isn't something they've got to think, oh, thank you so much, and they don't really want. But it's also something that you have had a hand in, and you've actually made it in your own kitchen. And I think that that is as big a gift, as good a gift as you can give.
How do you actually celebrate? Do you have a large group of people? Does it tend to be more intimate?
As the years go by, my Christmases get smaller, fewer people. In fact, I have even spent a Christmas on my own once, and I have to say thoroughly enjoyed it. But don't tell anyone. But, you know, I do all the things. Whether it's a big Christmas or just something intimate, I do all the things that you would do. I decorate the tree, which is the favourite time of the year, hanging little cookies on the tree, and I love all that. I make the mince pies. The idea that there is something in the house for somebody who calls. I make something for the carol singers. And Christmas itself, it's not just about the big meal. I know we all think about this one great big meal, but I know what happens in my house, that Christmas is actually a lot of little meals strung together and separated throughout the season. They've got to be just as special as the big meal because they're people you don't see very often, but not the actual Christmas meal itself. They've got to be something slightly different.
I think I might wander over to your house soon.
Oh, please. Please do. You'd be very, very welcome.
Oh, thank you. Nigel, may it be a very happy Christmas for you.
Thank you, and you too.
Nigel Slater's latest book is Tender, A Cook and His Vegetable Patch. Don't you want to just get on a plane, head for London, and knock on Nigel's door? I mean, really. Well, for a little sticky and a very crunchy sweet, bake a 5-nut caramel tart and serve it with small clementine oranges to eat with your fingers. You're going to find it all on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with the reclusive food writer Ed Baer and the art of soda making. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. Now, you want to do a party where people really pay attention to what they're drinking? Well, try making your own craft sodas. Now, these are the sodas that you can describe like wine. You can talk about the remarkable body, the delicious aftertaste. And there's a guidebook, Andrew Schloss, the cookbook author who has never just skimmed a subject, has done homemade soda. Andy, welcome back.
It's great being here again.
Well, nobody makes homemade soda Christmas gifts. So get us started with this. What would you have us do?
They're really easy to make, and you can make a lot at once, which is very convenient for making gifts. So I would do the one that comes to mind is spruce beer, which is a rendition of root beer and seems sort of Christmassy because it's sprucey. And what you do is make a traditional root beer, which basically is a sassafras tea, and you get sassafras root from homebrew stores or on the internet, or even some like herb kind of stores.
Uh-huh.
And then you're adding to that oil of spruce. And that and oil of spruce has a kind of wintergreeny flavor to it that is very delicious in root beer. So that would be one really unusual kind of old-fashioned soda that you could give that you just can't buy either. So it's a very homemade seeming thing.
And you could and decorate, then, I'm just thinking you could decorate the glass with a spruce branch.
You're so crafty.
I know. What does spruce beer taste like?
It tastes a lot like root beer, except it has this kind of wintergreen aspect.
So a minty, cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and root beers are very complex flavor systems. They're actually, we think of them as pretty simple foods, but if you actually think about that flavor, it's all this sort of woodsy, tart, highly aromatic, almost floral quality to root beer. Root beers are can be very complex and delicious.
I have to say, I have had root beers, you know, small, homemade or whatever root beers that have been stunning. They've been so good. And
yeah,
so I can
imagine.
Yeah,
they're a lot like more sophisticated brewed beverages. And then another thing, I think like a coffee soda because it's sort of hearty for wintertime. Espresso Jolt is a great, easy soda. You just take brewed espresso, sweeten it with some sugar, and then carbonate it. So that's a completely easy one. And then another one that we could do is that's sort of a takeoff on ginger ale is chocolate ginger ale, which is basically just you make a syrup with cocoa powder and sugar and ginger and then dilute it with water and carbonate it. So really easy and very sort of spicy and chocolatey and delicious.
How long will these things keep?
If you put them in a siphon, if you carbonate them that way, they'll keep about a week. If you do like a brewed method where you're adding yeast to the bottle, they will keep, 2 weeks under refrigeration,
uh-huh.
3 weeks maybe. And the danger isn't that they will go bad. The danger is that the carbonation will keep building in the bottle and you'll get what's called a gusher, which means when you try to open it, it's going to explode a little bit. But and what you can do is if you feel like that's going to happen, put it in a sink and just unscrew the cap very, very slowly.
Uh-huh.
And what will happen is the carbon dioxide will begin to leach out without letting liquid out. And if you do it really, really slowly, you can get it so that you calm down the soda and nothing will come out.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, sir, and happy holidays.
Same to you.
Andy Schloss is author of Homemade Soda. Try Andy's spruce beer recipe. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Ed Baer is the food writer too few people know about. His fame lies in the world of chefs and enthusiastic home cooks, but he and his magazine, The Art of Eating, should be better known. His recipes are simple. They're deceptively simple. But the devil is in the details of his writing. Ed tracks traditional dishes, threading through their histories and their techniques. Well, now he's done The Art of Eating cookbook, essential recipes from the first 25 years. Ed, it's good to have you here.
It's so much fun to be here.
Ed, how did The Art of Eating begin? How did you start it?
Oh, boy. It was 25 years ago, so it's the 25th anniversary of the magazine, and I was living in the obscure Northeast Kingdom town of... where was I at that time? Then I was in Peacham already, but...
This is Vermont, right?
This is Vermont. This is old school Northeastern Vermont. And a friend of mine had started a building trades publication, and he didn't even have power. So I figured if he did it, I could do something like that. And I'd been a carpenter, and I'd been, you know, I will say a carpenter has to know a lot, and an awful lot, but not that much in any given day. So I was looking for ways to use my mind more, and somehow I loved food more than I had ever been consciously aware. And this thing, which started out as an 8-page, humble, even almost too humble, black and white, newsletter, food letter, turned into a magazine all these years later.
So how many subscribers do you have?
Oh, goodness, not even quite 10,000. But we did a count, a year ago, we found we were in 52 countries. So,
wow.
So we have a certain kind, we attract a certain kind of person that's all over the world.
So why don't you describe how you come at a dish?
Well, it's usually something, oh boy, something that speaks to me. But then I want to know what it's all about. I love it when it's connected to a place, when there, it's a taste that really could have only come, or at its best, can only come from one particular spot on the globe. And then I start looking at climate and soil and culture that made the dish, everything that tells you what the essence of the dish is and explains how it came into being.
You know, you're called a traditionalist. But is that how you see yourself?
I'm certainly not offended by that. I think that tradition is this wonderful, wonderful anchor. But I love modern food. I mean, I'm happy to go to a fancy high-end restaurant and eat something wacky and crazy. But I think the tradition is such an anchor, and it's so important. And even for those wild and crazy chefs, they're almost, maybe without exception, anchored in some kind of tradition that you have to have a foundation. And I also think that traditional food, it comes from before the time when we were distracted by so many other things, by transportation and electronics and so on. It's when food was more central to everyday happiness. So those dishes are really considered. People have really thought about them. And that's why they're so satisfying and form a foundation.
What would you say today to people who want to cook but don't have a lot of time? What would you say to them about where to begin or just how to step into the kitchen?
Boy, I mean, I almost say don't even start with ingredients that don't even need transformation and just kind of get used to being in the kitchen. And I don't know, I used to sometimes stand at the counter and eat and snack on great cheese and great bread or just a few kinds of things that really don't need preparation. Cured meats, olives, I mean, you know, it goes on and on. And then begin to just do the simplest kind of cooking. You know, I mean, you can fry a piece of meat in fat very quickly and salt and pepper and some nice little condiment. I mean, it could be capers and salt, could be a squeeze of lemon, could be parsley from the garden. Mm-hmm. Just begin in the simplest ways and then just keep adding. But certainly, whatever you do, don't make it a burden. Find the pleasure in it. It's so relaxing to do something physical at the end of a day when you've been doing something which is just keyboard and mind and eyes.
Yeah. The holidays are here. Where do you get ideas and what foods for you are the holidays?
Well, I'm so reflexive. I mean, I go to Chestnuts, big roasts of meat, you know, big pieces of meat you can carve at the table. Onions, kind of big, lusty, full-flavored foods. Potatoes, of course, have to have a place. I'm a huge fan of said chestnuts. I always make a chestnut soup at this time of year. We have chestnuts in the refrigerator right now as I speak, waiting to be cooked into something like soup. I love things with red wine at this time of year, like red wine reductions. This includes also pears poached in red wine with the red wine reduced almost to a syrup.
You're
spices.
Such a traditional.
I know. I'm so sorry.
Don't apologize.
But this is the time of year for it. This is the time of year for it.
And thanks for talking with us.
My huge pleasure, Lynn. Thank you so much.
And may your feast this year be wonderful.
Thank you. You too.
Ed Baer's book is The Art of Eating Cookbook, and he left us with the recipe for that chestnut soup. It's up on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, the perfect foil for that fancy soup and all the super elegant food that we're eating at this time of year is Sally Swift's recipe for iced fudge lollies. These are chocolate popsicles that taste as rich as can be. And the way you serve them is you crisscross two of them on a dessert plate. And at every place, you have little pots of whipped cream in one dish, and you have salted pistachios in the other. You dip the tip of the fudgesicle first in the cream and then in the chopped salty pistachios. And they taste utterly fabulous, and everybody gets a hoot out of them. Just when they're expecting that lavish bouche de Noël, they get popsicles. And of course, nobody knows that they take 5 minutes to make. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern join us every week with the finds that they report on their roadfood.com website. But we get to actually talk to them. Hey, you two, it's good to have you back. So what's been happening? What's the latest discovery?
In the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, the UP, which, as you know, Lynn, is inhabited by people who call themselves Upers because of the UP, there's a little place in a town called Trenery, right in the center of the Upper Peninsula, and the name of the place is the Trenery Home Bakery. Now, many people who spend time in the Upper Peninsula, and even people who spend time in Lower Michigan, know something that comes from there called Trenery Toast. And if I describe it to you, it doesn't sound – it's very plain. It's kind of like – it reminds me of zwieback or biscotti, you know, one of those twice-cooked toasts.
Mandelbrot.
Or Mandelbrot.
I love those things.
Well, you know, the thing is, anybody who likes coffee automatically loves these things. And Trenery Toast, it's the simplest thing in the world. There is one place that makes it, the Trenery Home Bakery, and they pack it up in these lovely little brown bags, and it's sold throughout the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And it's one of those foods that when you move away from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you crave, because you can't get anything quite exactly like it.
So what exactly is it?
It's a little piece of sort of oblong toast that has like cinnamon sugar on it. I think you can get it either sugared or with cinnamon sugar. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very brittle. You know, brittle and dense enough so that if you want, you can dunk it and it will come out of the coffee intact.
You know, there's something about northern climates that I think people really like. Hard tack, if that's the correct word, because I know in Vermont, at the Vermont Country Store and, you know, up north in the Northeast Kingdom, you get those great crackers, those incredibly hard soup crackers.
Store crackers
that will just, you know, knock out any teeth in your mouth that aren't perfectly done.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Also in the UP, the Trenery Toast is like, you know, oh, gosh, I almost said it's like a dog biscuit, but it is in the sense that it's a hard chew. This is not mushy food, and I find it absolutely delicious.
Yeah.
And it's one of those Michigan things. You know, if you live in Michigan, you take, for example, Werner's ginger ale for granted. But then you move away and you think, oh, my gosh, no ginger ale tastes like that. And Trenery Toast is the same thing.
Do you like hard food?
I do. And you know what you're reminding me of? That old-fashioned German gingerbread.
That I love that.
Yes. The really hard stuff. That used to be done by apothecaries, and you would eat it dunking it in milk or water, but it was also soaked to become baby food. It was like the original pablum.
Exactly. You know what my favorite cookie is?
What?
The Italian cookie, Bones of the Dead.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, which you can break a tooth on.
So
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So we have to go to Michigan and have Trenery Toast. Yeah,
to the UP. Join the Upers. Okay. But only temporarily. They don't want anyone moving up there.
I understand. So we just go get the toast and we leave immediately.
And run.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, thank you. Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's site is roadfood.com.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said, look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We've got Eve calling from Coralville, Iowa. Eve, what do you want to talk about?
Happy holidays, Lynn.
Oh, thank you, ma'am. Happy holidays to you, too.
Thank you very much. In the 1823 poem that we now call "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," Professor Clement Moore wrote about sugar plums. Now, I have found over a dozen recipes with and without plums. No two are alike. What are sugar plums and how do you make them?
Oh, boy. I'm going to have to take an educated guess. Okay. First of all, I wonder if it wasn't sort of a generic reference.
That's a difficult thing. There seems to be quite a bit of argument. Right now, the schools fall down into two groups, one of which was it was a fruit and nut combination, possibly stuffed into a plum, or the other one is it's a nut and sweet combination rolled in sugar. I'd rather like the second one. And interestingly enough, Disney's the one that puts that one forward.
You're kidding.
I'm not.
Are you a food historian?
I am not. I was just curious about this because I have seen references to it, and I have never seen anyone take a stab at saying that they had found a cookbook dating back that far that indicated that this is what they were speaking of.
I wonder if it wasn't a prune, only because if it is available at Christmas, it may have been something like a preserved plum.
Mm-hmm.
Let's fantasize a little bit. Okay. Fresh plums would have been pretty rare, right?
Mm-hmm. Because definitely.
But if you had taken a plum and put it into a bath of sugar back in the summer.
Yeah.
Right, which was a way of preserving it. In so many words, if you had candied a plum, which wouldn't have been unusual because people did candy fruits, and then stuffed it with a combination of fruit and nuts, dried fruit, nuts, maybe something with a bit of alcohol in it, rum or brandy, which was pretty typical, like a mincemeat almost. This may very well be what it was. Now tell me, did you find a recipe? I missed that. Did you?
I have found a series of recipes. Like I said, Disney had the largest variety on their website. But I did find, I believe it was Bon Appetit had it, and a few of the others did.
This is what I wonder, because, you know, there are terms that are used, like sugar plum, that they're not necessarily referring to a single fruit. But I wouldn't be surprised if this was something like dried plums that were mixed with other dried fruits, sugar syrup, nuts, that kind of thing, into small balls. You know, almost on the order of
a fruit cake.
A little fruit cake, yes, exactly. Maybe not baked necessarily as much as held together with sugar syrup and nuts and that kind of thing. Okay, all food historians out there, chime in.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, you also cannot buy them for Christmas, so there's a challenge to an entrepreneur to start selling them.
Eve, you have thrown down the gauntlet for us all.
I thank you very much, and I hope everyone has a good holiday.
And you too.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay, it is time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what food business began with $500 and is now one of Forbes' top 100 most promising companies? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I will talk. I am Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you are listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. But before we connect, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what food business began with $500 and became one of Forbes' most promising companies? Well, the company is Fresh Diet. Zalmi Dutchman created it back in 2005. He got the idea of delivering a day's worth of healthy meals to customers' homes. Not a new concept, but he started the business in his apartment with $500 on his credit card. He went to operating in several cities with an annual revenue of $17 million. Not a fortune, but Forbes says promising, and he's a man who created his own job from his own stove. Okay, we are ready to talk. Anything goes. 800-537-5252. You can friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, shoot us an email, go to splendidtable.org. It's Tim, and he's on the line from Lawton, Oklahoma. Tim, what do you want to talk about?
Well, what it is my grandmother, she sent me some cookies, and they were delicious, but she sent me quite a few. And I didn't get to them all.
Yeah.
And there was plenty left. I didn't want to throw them all out. They're dried and perfect now. And I was wondering if I could reuse them for kind of a pie shell or some sort of another confection, because they were just so delicious. They're kind of a hybrid between chocolate chip and peanut butter.
Aha. Okay. So if you heat that up, you may get burnt chocolate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but now wait a minute. All is not lost. Maybe heating them in some way doesn't make sense, but how about doing something frozen with them?
I'm okay with that.
What about good old-fashioned ice cream pie?
That sounds delicious.
Yeah. Take a pie pan.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Lightly butter it. Mm-hmm. Crush the cookies. Mix them with some melted butter.
Okay.
All right. I would throw in some crushed salted peanuts.
That sounds good.
Yeah, because the saltiness with the sweet will be really nice.
Oh, yes.
Really pack that in.
Mm-hmm.
Freeze that first. Then I would take whatever flavor ice cream you like. And I think what would really be nice would be to use a really good quality vanilla.
Yeah, like a nice vanilla bean.
Yeah, yeah, right. And then I would streak that with some homemade hot fudge. Soften the ice cream. Run some homemade hot fudge ice cream through that so it's kind of marbled.
I got you.
Right. With some salted peanuts so you echo what's in the crust.
Yes.
Pour that in. Do just half of the pie that way. Then I would crush up something like a Heath bar. Put that in as a layer. Then what I do is put in a whole layer of more of the ice cream. Freeze that. Top the whole thing with lightly sweetened whipped cream.
Put
some salted caramel on top of that. This is called completely over the top, and that's what I'd serve.
That sounds so delicious.
Yeah, that's called overkill.
So, never a bad thing with dessert.
Enjoy. Just enjoy there, okay?
Okay.
Bye, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Joy is calling from Lookout, West Virginia. Joy, what is on your mind, ma'am? What would you like to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I have a Christmas party I do for dear friends every year. We do it, maybe this is 10 or 12 years now, and
right.
I always pick a theme and follow it through. And so this year we're raising our own hog, and we raise fava beans, and I'm not exactly sure what to do with them.
Oh, boy. They're dried at this point?
They are dried, and the skins have been blanched.
So have the skins been taken off?
They have.
Oh, boy. You just went through the hardest part of the whole thing.
I'll say.
Oh, boy, because removing the skins from fava beans are just a royal pain in the neck. Oh, they're so well, I'll tell you one of the classical ways that they're done, and I think this could put the mashed potato out of business.
Okay.
Is that you take the dried fava beans and you simmer them with a thin sliced potato.
Okay.
And it would be something like a pound of favas to maybe one or two red skin potatoes, you know, the waxy potatoes.
Yep.
And you simmer those and until they're really falling apart, until you can puree them, essentially.
Okay.
And then what you do is it's salt. And I always throw, by the way, a couple of cloves of garlic into
perfect.
The pot. And I cut up an onion. None of this could hurt. Cooking
correct.
Any bean.
Right.
But,
okay.
But this is peasant food from the heel of the Italian boot.
All right.
And I just perfect. Think it, I just think it's utterly delicious because the favas have a sweet quality to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you do is you puree that and you give it just a little olive oil. You can serve it in scoops, or you just put it out in a big bowl with a well in the center with some nice olive oil or butter. And or what wouldn't hurt is a little bit of fried up bacon and all that. But any one of those things, because just you don't need a lot of fat. In fact, you don't need any fat at all, but it's a lovely, luxurious touch. And some black pepper and salt.
So will these be the consistency of more like hummus or thick mashed potatoes?
Thick mashed potatoes. And you can thin them with water.
So and then since I have several pounds, could you cook them not quite that far and use them? I was thinking like vinaigrette, lemon, garlic,
absolutely.
Something cold? Or?
Absolutely. And the other thing that's done with them is that they're cooked but kept, you know, they're tender, but they're still somewhat whole.
Mm-hmm.
And they are tossed with pasta.
Okay.
And shaved cheese and lemon and olive oil, and they're served warm.
Okay.
But yes, you could serve them as a salad.
And you could serve them with, if you have fresh fennel, but if you don't have fresh fennel, you could do it with just red onion, little bits of salami, and an oil and vinegar dressing, or lemon, fresh lemon. It would be just great.
Okay.
So, you know, anything you do with any other bean, you can do with these.
Well,
yeah,
great.
You're going to need more next year.
Okay.
Yeah, but get someone else to skin them.
Exactly.
You take care.
You
and
too.
Enjoy the fava beans.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Kathy is calling from Clayton, Indiana. Kathy, what's on your mind?
Well, I start my Christmas season, my seasonal baking or cooking, by making a recipe or a batch full of candied orange peel.
Right.
And when you make this, you end up with about 2 cups of the most beautiful, yellow, tangy, orange-flavored syrup.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I can't waste that, but right. I have no idea what to do with it.
Oh, ho, 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 ho.
I knew you would know.
Well, I don't know about no, but I've done the candied orange peel, and I love that syrup. Okay. Oh, by the way, that is wonderful over ice cream. Right there. I mean, you don't have to do any more work. Think about this. If you were to put a little bit of that orange peel into a salad of bitter winter greens and then make a straight oil and vinegar dressing and you put a little bit of that syrup in the dressing, just a hint, and put a few nuts into the salad, it would be so good, I cannot tell you.
That's kind of like a different approach to getting that same tang you would get with a dried cranberry or
you
something like
have
that.
It. Exactly. Oh. And it's just delicious. The other thing is you make a fruit pie, pear or apple, and you use that syrup in place of some of the sugar. And it just tastes like nothing on earth. The other thing you can do is that if you do anything open-faced in terms of a tart or whatever, boil the syrup down just a little bit more and glaze with that.
Ooh, okay.
All right. Another thing you can do with it is you take that, you take some dried fruit, you take brandy, and you immerse the dried fruit in that, like apricots, for instance, and you put it in an attractive jar, and you've got a house gift.
Oh, that's, well, and that actually ties in with one of the things I do. I make the dreaded fruitcake, but mine is delicious, as every fruitcake maker will tell you. But
Of course, absolutely,
the,
right?
The components, is there is brandy in the batter of the fruitcake, and there is also dried apricots and golden raisins and nuts.
Well, there
you go. Along with the orange peel, so
there
you go.
You know,
that all ties together extraordinarily well.
There you are. And by the way, that syrup will keep in the fridge for quite a while. And that syrup, by the way, could also go into a sorbet that you make with fresh orange.
Ooh.
Or a granita, where you just cut up the orange, puree it with that syrup, right, and a little grated orange peel, and then you put that into a container in the freezer, and as it starts to freeze, you know how it starts freezing on the outside?
Then you stir it a little
You
bit.
Stir it with a fork, and as it starts to freeze again, you stir it with a fork, and then you do that a few times, and you get those shaggy crystals, and you scoop that into glasses at the end of a meal, and maybe you put a little soft whipped cream on top of that, and you get a taste the likes of which, oh, boy, yeah.
Oh. Now,
so
see,
you have to make more syrup. I'm sorry. You got to make a lot
more
orange peel.
I was going to tell you, now I have a problem. There's not enough syrup now.
Well, you know, you called with a question, and we gave you answers.
these are brilliant. Thank you very much.
You are welcome, Kathy. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bob Antia is a man I've wanted to meet since I first heard about his love of port wine. Now, this is the fortified wine that can age for decades. It's usually pulled out for celebrations, but rarely is it collected the way Bob does it. He's not a wealthy man, but I understand that he's amassed hundreds of precious bottles. Bob, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, how many bottles of port do you have?
Oh, every year I do an inventory. I think it's around 1,100 right now.
What is the draw?
How do you explain a love? It just happened.
How did it happen?
I was in a Spanish or Mexican restaurant somewhere around the McDougal Street area, somewhere in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And was looking for some after-dinner wine or something, and I saw port, and I remember it clearly. It was a 63 Sandeman vintage bottle, and it was spectacular. Fell in love with it on the spot.
So did you start collecting right at that moment?
No, because it was so cheap at the time. I remember very clearly that we could find bottles of 63 Sandeman for $20 a piece.
And that's a pretty good vintage, from what I gather.
It is. It's absolutely wonderful. I'd probably pay $150 or $200 for it now.
Wow.
And then the economics of port slowly dawned on me, which is you really can't have good port at a reasonable price unless you buy it when it's produced.
Uh-huh.
And lay it down.
So you started sort of investing in port then?
Exactly.
Port's really sweet. So, I mean, do you drink port with all kinds of food, or do you usually have it at the end of a meal?
Oh, anytime.
You're an equal opportunity port drinker, right?
Absolutely. The only problem with drinking port, and it's a rule I have, is you can't open a bottle unless there are at least three people around. Good ports don't last very long sitting in a bottle. So a 25-year-old port might last a day or two, you know, at its peak flavor, where it oxidizes and the flavor goes downhill. And two people splitting a port is just not something I really want to participate in.
So what's the oldest bottle you've got?
A 33, a Croft 33.
And what makes this one special, other than its age?
That's it. It's actually, I bought two of them, and the first one I had, it was pretty awful.
Ah.
It has long since hit its prime. It was like a mediocre sherry.
All right, so what's the one that you think at this moment may be the most phenomenal that you'll drink?
Oh, that's simple. That's hands down. It's the 55 Taylor. Taylor Fladgate Yeadman. Oh, it is what I consider a perfect port.
And what is a perfect port?
It's a mixture. It's a balance. It's a interesting balance. I think of it as a triangle between the tannins, the sweetness, and the heat of the alcohol. And the 55 Taylor is just a perfect isosceles of a triangle. It's not too hot. It's got fruit. It's got the sweetness there. The heat is there but not predominant.
Uh-huh.
And the tannins still in balance with the fruit. Really a wonderful bottle.
Is there, in your estimation, an affordable sort of starter port?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The late bottle vintages are all eminently drinkable and all have the port characters.
So when you say late bottle, you mean recent vintages?
So there are a number of types of port. There's not a oneness in port. There's a vintage port, which I suspect makes up 1 or 2 or 3% of the total production.
Right.
And that's what I collect. It's stuff that you lay down, improves with age. There's something called the late bottle vintage, which sits in the casks in their aging vessels for 18 months or 2 years or 3 years or longer.
Mm-hmm.
It has all the qualities of port, but it isn't a blended port like the rubies or the tawnies. The rubies and the tawnies always taste the same. They're like a blended whiskey. Their tasters are going after a particular taste profile.
Right.
Which is usually good, but I like the variations of the ports, tasting the different ports.
Mm-hmm.
The late bottle vintages are inexpensive enough. They're usually under 20 and have that variation that I prefer.
And that'll be on the label, late bottle.
Yeah, it'll say late bottle vintages or LBV.
That's
I wouldn't say they're hard to find, but they're not easy to find.
Okay, but these are things we can also lay down.
They don't really improve with age, no. No.
Okay, so we just have to drink it right away. Oh,
well,
what a
you know,
shame.
You have one now and you have one later.
I wish I lived near you. I have a feeling I could catch some good port from you.
Well, and what I've consciously tried to do is get rid of the pretentiousness of port. That was the only thing that I didn't like about it. There's a, you know, old English manor house sort of thing that goes around with port. And I've tried to kill that off with my monthly port and poker games. Just a group of friends who get together once a month, and we open 2 to 3 bottles, depending on how many people are there, and sample it and discuss it and play poker.
Oh, that's a great idea. Bob, thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bob Antia is a port collector on the East Coast. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and until next week, let me leave you with this thought. This is the time of year you get homesick, even when you're home. Thank you. Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for more information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcasts, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest series, The Key Three Interviews, with chefs and good cooks about the key three recipes they think every good cook should know. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.